You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
This is episode 436, dated Friday, October 31st, Halloween, 2025.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to In Perspective. I'm Bob Branco. Good to be with all of you today. This is episode 436, dated Friday, October 31st, Halloween, 2025. Before we continue, let me introduce our friend, colleague, co-host back from Mexico, Peter O'Toole. How was your trip, Peter?
Boom. The trip was good. It was hot, but the ship was nice, good food. Good shows, a couple of nice tours, and the only problem is we came back with a stomach virus, but we seemed to recover from that, and I'm getting back to my old life. Here, the rainy season is officially starts tomorrow, and we're supposed to get a bunch of rain tomorrow, so this is Oregon weather, so you'll be hearing me talk about a lot of rain over the next six months.
We're windy and dry and seasonable right now after a humongous rain event last night. We're about 55 to 60 degrees or thereabouts. I want to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. They include Raymond Gay, our producer and editor. Thank you for what you do. Peter from Canada, thank you for posting our shows on one of your chat boards. We appreciate that. Also, our media sources, thank you very much for what you do. And, of course, Jacqueline Sylvia of JS Web Solutions, thank you for archiving our programs on my website. In order to find them, go to www.brancoevents.com, arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts, click on them, and you will see most of our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I want to say hi to Trish, who is our facilitator for today's program. Thank you very much for helping us out, and the same goes for Brad, our streamer. Thank you very much. And because we are being streamed, allow me to give out my email address because we encourage our listeners to send us letters letting us know what they think about our programs. It's always important to know what the listeners think. It's bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. Today we have with us Paul Edwards. Paul's done a lot of things, but specifically, he is a podcaster. He does a program called Tuesday Topics. He's also the second vice president of the Braille Revival League. And I would like to welcome you, Paul. Thanks for appearing today.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure indeed. I will now turn it over to Peter.
Thank you, Bob. So, Paul, I thought it'd be interesting to start with your experience in Jamaica. Talk about what prompted you to go there and how long you stayed and what you did there and what prompted you to leave?
So I went to Jamaica because my mom thought she was falling in love with a guy who supposedly owned kind of a third of the eastern part of the island. And so she packed up her two kids and three dogs and 13 and a half tons of furniture and moved us to Jamaica. And by the time we got there, the guy who she was in love with had been arrested in Canada for fraud. But I went to school there, sort of, and ended up getting a scholarship and studying history at the University College of the West Indies. It was part of the University of London, and enjoyed it a lot, and then ended up going to Trinidad to study international relations at a branch of the L'Institut de l'Etat Relations Internationales of Geneva that had opened on the St. Augustine campus there.
And you were blind when you were there, right?
I was.
So how is it, I mean, you know, to ask this sort of mundane question, how is it like being blind in Jamaica compared to, say, the United States?
Well, the only entity that served blind folks when I first got there was a Salvation Army school that was in Kingston. They had something of a Braille library, so I got a few books to read from there. But mostly I subsisted on recording for the blind books, and those were on flexible discs, if you guys remember what those were like.
Yeah, I remember them sort of well.
I remember them very well.
Yeah. So, and how do you think that your experience in Jamaica, we'll come back to your move to the States in a second, but how do you think that experience in Jamaica shaped your life, the rest of your life?
Well, I love the Caribbean and I love the environment. I think that anyone who has spent any significant amount of time in a country like Jamaica or Trinidad has a different sense of the reality of the world, because that person is not in an environment where white folks are at the top of the pyramid and have all the power, because both Trinidad and Jamaica were just becoming independent when I was there. And as a result, they were going through a lot of changes, not only in terms of the folks who were in power, because obviously the British, who were white, were in charge of both to begin with, but more importantly, developing an identity that was different from the identity that they had as colonies of Britain, and developing one as independent nations with an entirely different set of values and philosophies.
I guess, how different are they? I mean, I know Jamaica still is a member of the British Commonwealth. I know they're an independent country. I get all that.
You know, Trinidad is too.
And Trinidad is too.
But I think that both countries essentially perceive themselves as countries who have, and quite rightly, as countries who suffered under colonialism, and both of them have developed a philosophy that essentially says we have to develop an identity of our own, because the one that the British tried to give us was perhaps an erroneous one.
Well, it was forced on them too, right? I mean, it's not as if there was a choice in the matter.
And right.
Nobody likes to have things forced on them, as we know fairly well.
Right.
And of course, we all feel right now for those folks who live in Jamaica after what they've gone through this week. Our thoughts and prayers go out to people around Jamaica, Cuba, and the Bahamas, as a matter of fact, for the devastation that they went through with Hurricane Melissa.
Yeah, Bermuda too.
Bermuda also.
Do you still have contacts in Jamaica? And have you heard anything?
I have not heard anything this week. And I do know a number of people in Jamaica, but really haven't done a good job of keeping in contact with those folks.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's a terrible thing. And I just hope they can, you know, build back over time. But boy, what a thing. So you came, what prompted you to leave Jamaica and come to the United States?
Well, I went to Trinidad after Jamaica.
Right.
And did a master's degree there. And at the end of the master's degree, ended up getting married, which meant that I had to find some way to earn some money. And I ended up teaching high school for 10 years in Trinidad, teaching history of all things. And other subjects, English and a thing called the general subject, which is an A-level subject, which involved teaching people to think and how to put that into writing, because they had to write essays at the end. But that was a fun experience, and I love Trinidad just as I love Jamaica. Trinidad is much more multicultural, and I came back to the States essentially because it was time. I'd come up a year before and met with the Division of Blind Services, and they made all kinds of promises about all the things they were going to do and how wonderful I was and everything was going to be perfect. And then I got up there and the person who had made the promises was gone. And eventually I found my own job down the road. So yeah, and I came back to Miami and lived there for several till I got a job in Daytona where I moved. Then I moved there and got to know people like Patricia there, and then eventually moved to Jacksonville and then back to Miami when I went to work for the Miami-Dade College.
Are you there now in Miami?
No, I moved back to Jacksonville.
Okay.
Before we go back, before we go to your experience with Miami-Dade, which that's when I first met you when you were working at Miami-Dade.
Right.
Can you talk about your sort of your experience teaching as a blind man in Trinidad?
Initially, I wasn't sure whether I could do it or not. And when I had applied for jobs as a history teacher, everybody essentially said, no, thank you. So I got a job at a school called St. Charles, which was way out in the country in Trinidad. And it was a school for folks who had not passed what was called the 11 plus exam. And the 11 plus exam is an exam that operates in the British Commonwealth to segregate kids who are going to go to secondary school and kids who will go on for a few more years in something like extended primary school. Some of their parents want those kids to get out of that. And so they enroll them in kind of a private high school. So I taught there for a year for almost no money. I mean, maybe, it was $300 a month Trinidad, which would be about $75 a month in terms of U.S. money then. And I needed to convince myself that I could control a classroom, that I could get homework marked, that I could do all that kind of stuff. And remember, no such thing as counselors or any of those things in the Caribbean who are going to provide anything. But that was okay because remember, there weren't such things when I went to university either. So it was very much an effort of designing the things that worked for me. And then after a year when I discovered that maybe I was actually pretty decent at teaching, what I then did was to really start beating down doors and saying, look, I have better qualifications than most people who are applying for this position. And so you darn well better give me a job. And then I got a job in a school that was kind of the biggest Anglican high school in Trinidad as the lead history master, and stayed there for 10 years and enjoyed teaching.
So I want to leap forward into your experiences at Miami-Dade Community College. You ultimately ended up running their disability services office, correct?
Yes.
So talk about the work you did there, and how do you think that experience in Jamaica influenced you, the way you thought about people with disabilities and helping them become more self-sufficient and all that good stuff?
Well, I think there was a huge adjustment for me coming from the Caribbean and moving to the United States, because it's a very different environment. There really aren't a lot of services for blind folks in the Caribbean. There are more now than there were then. But when I got to this country, what I found was a lot of folks with disabilities, I think, have an attitude that they are almost entitled. And I found that very hard to deal with, because there were so many people who were disabled in Trinidad and in Jamaica who really had to find their way towards a bright future with many more obstacles in their path than operated here. So to answer your question, I think that I had expectations of people with disabilities that might have been a little higher than some of the people with disabilities' expectations of themselves were.
And the staff who supported them too, correct? It wasn't just
sure.
Students,
yeah, I mean, there were lots of disabled students who chose to leave the campus that I ran and went somewhere else, because I wouldn't give them services that I didn't think they needed. And instead expected them to figure out ways to cope with work themselves. Because essentially, if you graduate somebody from college who's incapable of operating independently and can't do anything on his or her own, they're not going to get a job.
Right. 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 So how did you, it's a
balance any act you're trying to accomplish. You want to provide the services that make sense. You don't want to scare people away. It's, you know, it isn't Halloween after all, except for today. And, but yet you want to still have, what kinds of things did you do to sort of promote that kind of self-sufficiency, independence that?
Well, there were lots of things. I mean, the first thing that I did was to write a curriculum and get it adopted by the state for a 4-credit class on access technology for blind folks. Because my experience was that many of the kids who were coming to college simply didn't have the access technology skills they needed to be successful. And once I got that approved, I encouraged all of the blind students who came to my campus to take that class. I obviously made all of the equipment that students needed available, not only in areas around access services, but in learning labs all over the campus. So, you know, any student who wanted to study in the library would find JAWS and other access components available to them, and CCTVs and the whole nine yards. So anything that students needed in terms of equipment and that kind of thing, I tried to make available. I also provided them with the tools. And I think that I was the only college, or one of the few colleges anyway, in the campuses even, in the country, that actually operated a tutorial lab for individuals who needed extra help. And this particularly applied to learning disabilities. We trained our note takers and trained our tutors so that they understood what the needs of students with disabilities were, and tried to pay them a pretty decent wage, so that what students had were the tools that they needed to be effective, that they were prepared to use them, and most were.
And my understanding, Paul, is that in many cases, and those note takers of people with learning disabilities actually take notes. I mean, I know this kind of silly, but part of what I think you were trying to accomplish is to help people with learning disabilities take their own notes.
Absolutely.
So talk about how you sort of, you know, again, created that balance. How did that work?
Well, there is no reason why a blind person shouldn't be able to take their own notes in a class like English or a class like Spanish.
Right.
And, they may need a note taker in a class like math. And I was prepared to recognize that was a possibility, but I provided them with instructions in our learning center on how to take notes. And then they, as far as I was concerned, were on their own. And by the same token, if a student came to me and said, my professor is treating me badly and you need to intervene, I would essentially say to that student, I'm not going to intervene until you've gone to see the professor first.
Mm-hmm. What tools did the students use to take notes for the most part, blind ones especially?
Most blind students had access to either laptop computers or they had note takers. And, you know, those of them who were partially sighted generally wrote their notes either with a computer or in longhand large print. But the other thing if a note taker took notes in longhand, those would generally be transcribed and turned into either small or large print copy that would then be given to the students. So there wouldn't be an issue of whether they could read them or not.
Right. So you did this. I'll talk about a little bit about how you prepared these students for the work world. What kinds of things did you do to prepare those students to get a job and keep a job and all that good stuff?
I wrote quite a few grants. We had a vocational education grant that we operated with virtually every year. And we worked very hard with our career center at the college to create some accessible components that folks with all disabilities could use, and also did some training in the career center to make certain that folks were comfortable dealing with individuals with disabilities. We created places where vocational rehabilitation, the Division of Blind Services, could meet with students on campus. And I also ran some grants for high school kids that I had written, some federal grants. And these were similar to what has turned out to be pretty popular with some of the new regulations that are in place, but this was essentially job training and work experience for kids during the school year and during the summer. And if you run grants like that, right, kids can be really successful. And I hired some really good people to run those grants, and they did well with them.
So I want to make a big leap.
Yes.
To your terms as president of ACB. Sort of talk about how things were back then, what you accomplished, anything you want to talk about those years. When were you president? Let's start with that. What years were you president of ACB?
I think 1997 to 2003, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. But talk about sort of the kinds of work you were doing, the challenges you experienced, and that kind of stuff, and what some of your successes.
So ACB was at a point where we were transitioning from a very old school ACB to a slightly more modern one. We elevated our national representative to a position where they came to be called an executive director. And then I went out and persuaded Charlie Crawford to come work for me. He had been commissioner for the blind in Massachusetts.
Yeah. I know him personally.
Yeah. And was able to persuade him to come and work for ACB. And I think that was a huge step forward for us. And so Charlie and I and Brian Charlson was my first vice president. So the three of us, certainly at the top of a pyramid, tried to make a number of changes to alter the way that ACB was perceived in the wider world. And I think we were pretty successful at that. I was responsible for getting ACB radio in place and hiring Jonathan Mosen to come work for us. And I was proud of that. Spent quite a lot of time looking at what membership in ACB for an organization of folks who were gay might look like, and eventually persuaded ACB that it would be appropriate to create an organization of folks with different lifestyles. So, and I continue to be pretty proud of that. We worked a lot. We worked a lot at diversifying those people who were involved in leadership, and spent quite a long time putting committees together where we tried to build balances between the various groups that are out there, young and old, and folks with different minorities and a range of other things like that. So it was a fun time. It was a tough thing to do. It is hard to hold a full-time job where you're managing 50 people. Yeah. And be ACB president as well.
I know Brian Charlson also. He was in charge of the computer training program at the Carroll Center for the Blind.
He was.
What was sort of the legislative climate like back then? And what legislation were you looking at to?
We were right at the beginning of creating some of the things that we take for granted now, like accessible pedestrian signals and tactile markings on streets. Most of the regulations that have subsequently come into effect were essentially being developed then, because the ADA was pretty new still. Remember, it was only passed in 1992, so it was only 5 years old when I became president.
Sure. So talk about a little bit how you found that balance between managing 50 employees and then running an organization. That's a lot of work. How did you find the time to do both well?
I think it means giving up a lot of personal life, and in a sense, I'm really sorry, because in 2005, my wife Gail died of leukemia. And probably the thing I regret most is that I allowed myself to be so caught up in ACB that I don't think I spent nearly the amount of time with her that I could have and that she deserved. So whatever you do, you lose. I mean, there's just no question about that. And I think that people also need to remember that we're talking about a very different environment where you didn't have the internet. Everything had to be done by phone or by travel. I mean, there were years when I was gone from home 32 or 34 weekends for ACB. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line, I guess, for me is we're here to try to make things better if we can. And if we can contribute to doing that, I think it's a good thing.
Well, your organization does very fine work, Paul, I must tell you.
Thank you.
Your story reminds me, Paul, of a choice that my wife made. Very, very bright woman, had lots of potential. She was working towards her master's and MBA and probably would have done very well for herself professionally, but made a conscious decision to move from Portland, Oregon back to where she was raised in Coos Bay, Oregon, and to raise her kids and to, you know, and it stunted her professional growth, but it was a choice she consciously made. And the result for her is that she now has a great family and a great grandkids that, and it's just wonderful to be a part of. You know,
And is a great person too, so.
That's right. Yeah. But you get the idea. You know, we all make choices, sure. But you know, Carrie could have been a really smart executive.
Oh, I'm sure that's right.
You know, and she chose not to, and I admire her for that choice. I'm not sure I would have made that choice if given the circumstances, but.
Right. Oh, it's a hard choice. It's a hard choice to make.
Yeah. It's a very hard choice to make. So I want, before we throw it for questions, I want to sort of jump to the current time. Oh, stop. I'll deal with you later. Sorry about that. So I am curious. We were in a very different time than we were, I think, between 1997 and 2003 when you were president. We're in a different environment. And we're also in a different environment than when you were doing all those creative things that you were doing at Day Community College. I guess my question is, what can we learn from back doing the work back in 1997 and earlier and later, and what should we be thinking about doing differently? What do you think it just seems we're in a very different place.
I don't think that fundamentally what we need to do has changed an awful lot. We still have to put ourselves out there and we still have to ask for what we need, and we still have to be convinced that there's still a lot to be done. And in fact, there may now be more to be done than there was between 1997 and 2003. Then there was beginning to be a respect for people with disabilities, and that respect is not nearly so widely held now as it was then. And I think we really need to be out there demanding our place and saying to folks whatever individuals currently are saying about our value, we need to recognize and have you recognize that we're still as cool as we always were and we still have the same needs and the same rights. I mean, to eviscerate services and to limit the respect given to people with disabilities in and to other minorities, by the way, is a clear and unequivocal crime. And we need to stand up and be counted as individuals who stand on the side that says this is not okay.
I am compelled.
How do we do that now in a fractured culture? That's the thing that strikes me as so different from the way things were, you know, when you were president and I was doing the bulk of my professional work. We were more bound together as a culture. There are things, and now it seems to me we're in our different echo chambers is the big word that's used more often than not. And I guess the question I'm wondering is, how do we account for that? How do we make those adjustments so that, you know,
well, we can, I think, do as you I suggest? Think one of the, I mean, one of the things we do is we continue to dialogue. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I do Tuesday Topics. I think we need to create environments where people can appropriately interact with each other and can talk in a reasonable way, even if they have widely differing views. And Bob, you were asking something?
Yes, I'm just compelled to ask you this question because it's been talked about a lot, especially amongst the blind population lately. Has the unemployment rate of the blind gone down in the past 40 years? I'm hearing it hasn't.
Well, Peter and I have had lots of discussions over this on Tuesday Topics, but what I would urge you to take a look at is some data. It's old now. It was published covering the year 2019. But what it does is it provides the first, I think, really valid data concerning the unemployment of blind folks. And what it says is that we've probably been couching that question in the wrong way. I don't know how much unemployment of blind people has changed because the only year that I trust is the 2019 data. I hope we'll get some. The reason we didn't get more is because COVID came along, and I keep hoping that we can persuade some folks to find some money for us to do another year's data that we could compare with 2019. But at the core of what the data says is that the employment situation is much more complicated than simply setting an unemployment rate at 70% or whatever the heck you want to use as a figure. Because the big data demonstrates there are bunches of people who are blind who are simply not seeking employment, partly because of illness. Amazingly, because of mental illness, which I don't think most of us recognize as serious a problem as it appears to be. And third, that there were a bunch of people who were severely underemployed to the point where they hardly counted as full-time employees, but were actually doing some work. And that's the whole group of folks who have determined that they're not prepared to lose the funds that they have, and therefore they will only work for a minimal amount of time and at minimum wages. So to answer your question is I don't think that anybody who is being honest knows the answer to your question. But what we do know is that the situation is far more complicated than vocational rehabilitation or blind services had regarded it.
It is complicated. And regarding the mental illness piece, I think I've told you this story, Paul, but I may not have. When I was doing some work with the ACB scholarship winners a couple of years ago, I asked people to volunteer if they had other disabilities besides blindness. And about half acknowledged that, which I found extraordinary. In other words,
it is extraordinary, but what's even more extraordinary is that for the most part, vocational rehabilitation and blind services and those who are probably handling transition in schools aren't recognizing or valuing it as a serious limitation to the capacity of individuals to function effectively.
And they need different kinds of services, right? It's not.
Right.
They need, right, in order to be able to, you know, to adjust or whatever word you want to use.
Absolutely right.
Different approach. And so then I asked, okay, does anybody like to share what those other disabilities are? In other words, you know, first I asked, you know, do you have other disabilities? And most of them who chose to identify, you know, some didn't, had mentioned some kind of mental illness of some kind. And, you know, for me, that was an eye-opening, I'm sorry, a thing that these are very talented people. They won scholarships. They're doing their thing. They're doing great work. And they're dealing with more than one disability.
Correct.
And I think that's something we need to think about as we talk about this stuff. I think it's time for questions, isn't it, Bob?
It is time for questions. And before I turn the festivities over to our participants, let me say hi to somebody who wrote in, said some very nice things about our program recently. That's Marlene Massot of Behind Our Eyes. Thank you very much for your comments. We appreciate them very much. All right. So you are listening to In Perspective. Our guest is Paul Edwards. Trish, do anybody have their hands raised at the moment?
Yes, we actually have two. The first one is Melody. Go ahead.
Good evening. Or I should say good afternoon. Hello. Welcome to In Perspective with Melody? Bob, Peter, and Paul.
Go ahead and unmute, please.
First of all, Paul, my friend, I'm thankful that I got here because I thought it was going to be Kim Charleston speaking. Peter, I commend you for your post. That's what it had in the community events, and I don't know
it
how
did.
I knew.
It did.
But you are one of the most intuitive, spot-on, hit-on-the-button people I have ever known, just in personal conversation and whatever community events that I may hear you. I don't know how you can hit right where it needs to be hit at a certain time. I had someone from my chapter today just tell me, happened to be a member of the Sunshine Committee, I don't know anyone else besides you with a whole bunch of additional conditions and disabilities. I said, trust me on this one. If you do nothing else, yes, you do. And I was thinking about the Braille and Speaks and taking notes school and college and how phenomenal they were. Just that across yep. file sharing and missing them and wishing I had one right in my hands. You're one of the best people I personally know, and under your administration, I think I would have gotten a lot of help. I did want to ask you your opinion on, I'm trying to keep thought together, it's becoming harder, just the ways in which people with disabilities are left out of the mainstream media when thinking of other DIA-type groups, and the A's not there, and how we're controlled, and it's legal, and what is actually a crime that goes under the table, and how it can really get someone and try to fight it.
Before I ask that question, Paul.
Yep.
What is, just for the record, DIA is?
DIA, Paul?
I'm not sure I know.
I think what she's saying is other underrepresented groups that,
right.
Diversity, equity, inclusion without the exception.
Oh, got it. DEI.
Thank you.
DEI.
That's helpful. Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Melly.
Yeah.
So. I'm not sure I have all the answers, and I'm not sure that anybody has. I think that the core thing that we need to do is to first stand up for who we are, but I also think that we need to recognize that what's happening now is most of the elements that enable folks who are from minorities, whether they're disabilities or other ones, most of the components that provide a system in which they can prosper are being taken away. And when that happens, I don't think any of us know what the net result will be. In the long run, I think we can guarantee that it's going to cost society more money because fewer and fewer folks are going to be successful and more are going to be supported by governmental dollars. Now, if those end up being taken away, then we'll go back to a much more primitive time. I don't think it's impossible, but I think that the only way that we can prevent it is by continuing to be out there in public, standing for and as who we are, and saying to society, we demand to be valued and accepted, and we insist that we need the tools that will enable us to be successful. And
Paul,
and,
one of the, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, Bob. Yep.
One of the things that I've always said, and I'm a blind person like mostly everybody else that are on this program right now, is that the one way that you can provide your own, I'll use a term for lack of a better term, public relations about blindness is to be yourself. Be yourself. You know what I mean?
But also don't hide in your house. Get out there.
That's right.
Become a part of the community. Well, go to PTA meetings. Get involved in politics.
That's part of being ourselves. To be like everybody else. Go out like everybody else. Go out to eat like everybody else.
Exactly.
The complexities of all this is the whole concept of disability porn, you know, where we disabled people are admired for just getting out of bed and putting our clothes on or something. And we're miracles or something. And that's not helpful either. We got to find the right balance between, you know, being
effective people and acknowledging that we need certain supports, whatever they are. And I think that's the challenge.
Yep.
Anyway, that's another conversation. Thank you so much. Was that Melody who said that?
Yeah.
Who's next?
Yeah.
Thank you, Melody. Trish, do we have anybody else?
Yes, we actually have two more currently. Next one is Jeanette.
Hello, so, Jeanette.
Paul, I have two questions for you.
Yes, ma'am.
And the first one is, in the environment in Jamaica, I know because my mother went to school under the British system,
yep,
being British, that your education was significantly better than what many people get in this country. Did you also have basic tools like a white cane, or did you do all of your traveling, you know, without it and with figuring it out other ways?
I got my first orientation mobility training about a year after I got back to the States at the age of 31 or 32.
See, you're even later than mine. Mine was about 15.
I didn't have, I had a typewriter and I had a tape recorder and a braille writer, but really that's about it.
But that's pretty impressive for over there.
And had to really invent the ways that school would work and invent the ways that university would work because there was nobody there to tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And my second and final question is, in the world of, if you had one wish for up and coming students now, you know, that you think every rehab department, every school, every college prep program should give blind young adults, what would you say is the most important skill they have to have before they can attend college?
I would love it if every blind student who came to college had a good capacity to handle technology, because a lot of colleges and universities aren't providing them with the training. And so I think many blind kids fail in college simply because they don't have the technological groundwork that they need. We're supposed to provide it to them in high school, but I don't think we're really doing it. Certainly the evidence in the place where Miami-Dade was is that we're not doing it.
Yeah.
And without that technology, especially today, kids simply won't succeed, because everything now more and more depends on technology.
We agree.
Thank you. And I would ask, if what technology? I mean, it's really clear to me, for example, that AI and chat GPT and all those Gemini and all those things are coming. And so I was
exactly. I mean, they're very important. All of those things are important, but so are things like being competent at email and media. You know, I'm old now, so I have chosen not to do things like Facebook and Mastodon, but I'm not sure a young kid can make that decision.
Yeah.
Because all young kids know are the technology.
Correct. And if blind kids have been allowed to be sheltered under TVIs, teachers of the visually impaired, what ends up happening is they're simply at a place where they're not going to effectively fit in once they get to a college or university environment.
But you know, Paul, it's a bigger problem, because I hear this every day in general. It's about kids in general, blind or sighted. They spend so much time on their devices in the house. You don't see them out playing as much as they used to. And this is a basic problem in general in this society.
Well, I think that's right. But the blind kids don't spend the time on their devices except talking book players.
Well, that's another subject.
But that's an important distinction, though, because, you know, while sighted people are doing stuff on the computer and learning about all this stuff, many blind folks aren't. And for better or for worse. And that's That's a real problem.
Thank you. I know a lot of blind people who do use iPhones very effectively.
iPhones are great, sure. but that's only part of the situation. You know, Voc Rehab in Oregon is now beginning to rethink, okay, now that more people are using ChatGPT, how do we alter our technology training to deal with this? And it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
And it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a very good thing. At least we're doing it. You know, yep. At places like other states I lived in, forget it. You know, so anyway, thank you so much. We had another caller,
right, Trish?
Yes, we have another hand. Nigel, go ahead.
Nigel, brother Nigel. How are you, sir?
Mm-hmm.
Hello? Brother Nigel from Florida.
Yeah.
Nigel, you need to unmute.
Nigel is quite famous. He was one of the early IBM workers. He worked as a computer programmer for IBM in the 80s.
Hmm. Oh.
Nigel, you're still muted. Let me see here. All right, let me send him a prompt.
If we have somebody behind him. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we don't have anybody else at the moment. Nigel, go ahead. I just sent you the prompt. I guess he's having trouble. Oh, wait, we do have another hand. Hold on.
Okay.
We'll take that one first.
Let's move on to Mr. John McCann.
Ah.
John McCann.
Hey, John McCann.
Welcome. Oh, my.
Another AC.
Okay, should be unmuted now.
There he is.
You're all set, John.
There you go.
Hey,
well,
John.
Hey, Paul. Good to hear you on and decided to see what you had to say these days. Haven't really been in touch with you for a bit of time, you know. Well, you said that you taught history, and I'm a great fan of history. So just to keep the record straight, you were president from 95 to 01.
Thank you.
Yes, it was 1995. Too. We had a 30-year period of presidents that all served 3 terms. Saunders, you, Chris Gray, Mitch Pomerantz, and then Kim Charlson.
Kim, yep.
And you were the second of those 6-year guys, you know, persons. So
thank you.
And you, certainly, you know, was reliving those memories. Of course, I was friends with many of the people who were on the board. At that time, I had made a decision to prioritize the responsibilities to my, then young daughter, who is now on the verge of, well, just turned 39, and I have one grandkid. But the point is,
wow,
that she was 8 and 9, you know, going up to the teenage years. And that's why I didn't attend conventions at that time and whatnot, but, was very tangentially involved with ACB at the time. And then later expanded that involvement, of course, when I was on the board from 2012 to 2019. And
you were,
yeah, you know, but it was an interesting time to say the least with, the upgrading of the national representative position and all.
Right. And John is a guitarist extraordinaire to you guys.
I never knew that about John.
You didn't know that?
He was an attorney, but I didn't know he was a guitarist.
Yeah.
He is.
Oh, yeah.
He and I used to spend a lot of time singing together because.
Yes. John, we're all folkies together. You know,
our taste is both folk oriented. So.
Very much so.
Were you with the band, John? Were you with the
band? As a kid, yeah. I mean, I was, you know, I was in a rock band as a teenager, and then I did a lot of coffee house stuff in my college and law school years, and bluegrass most recently. We even did an album in very, very early 2020, and when we were about to really kind of take it on the road statewide, then COVID hit. So, but this isn't about me. This is about,
that's right. It's
ACB.
About Paul today.
Yeah, it's about Paul today. So, I just forget to jump in since KB4F is sort of missing in action. He's a fellow amateur radio operator with one of those nice, cool, short call signs.
Yep.
Yes, you know. And just wanted to recognize all the great things that Paul had done for ACB, is still doing for ACB, but had done back in the day, which is scarily enough going back 30 years to when you first began your presidency. So
that is scary. And the fact that I'm now the oldest surviving president is pretty scary.
Yeah, that would be true. Of course, Mitch and Kim and Dan and even Chris Gray are still alive, but you've trumped them age-wise, so.
Yep.
Well, maybe I've given KB4F, the aforementioned Nigel, time to unmute and
let's
whatnot,
hope so.
But yeah, let's hope so.
Yep.
Thanks,
John.
Thank you, John. Sure. Nigel, are you there?
Yep, I think he's unmuted. Go ahead, Nigel. You are unmuted, Nigel.
Go ahead, Nigel. The floor is yours.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently.
So he is unmuted.
I don't know.
Maybe
what
he left his headquarters.
His mic doesn't work.
Something happened because Nigel's always.
We were talking to him before the show started. Remember, Paul?
Oh, really?
I do.
Yeah.
That is weird.
Okay. So, well, Paul, we don't have any more hands at the moment.
Okay. If that changes, please let us know.
I will.
So Paul, what strikes me about our conversation and prior conversations you and I have had is your creativity in sort of developing solutions for yourself and for the programs that you ran at Dade College. And it seems to me that we need a lot more of that now, more than any other time and since I've been around, to find those creative programs, to find creative ways of funding them, because I'm not sure the government's going to be available to do that as much, or they want to or something. It seems to me we need a lot more creativity in the world than there seems to be now, or it should be honored more or something. What do you think?
I think you're probably right. I think we can expect less from the federal government anyway. But one of the things that I think we ought to be doing is looking at states and also at local levels, mm-hmm. to see whether we can't carve out a place where folks with disabilities can be better accepted and better valued. You know, I think there's an awful lot of things that are going to devolve to the states if the current administration has its way. And what that means is we need to quickly jump in where many of us in many states haven't been. I don't know how many of our affiliates even go to state legislatures anymore. Florida's been doing it for the past 3 years. So we have some contacts. How much good that will do us remains to be seen. But I think it's really important that every state think about building some different bridges than the ones that we thought we needed before.
And I also think one of the things I've learned over the past years is working on the employment committee chair is there are some very creative employment programs out there where people are being trained on certain skills that employers need, and they go through their program, and then employers, hold your breath, actually hire them.
Yes.
And I think we need to support those kinds of programs as well and encourage more of them. I don't know quite how you do that. What's that?
There's an outfit called NSITE that operates.
That's what I was thinking about. Yes.
Through National Industries for the Blind, that's doing some really good work now. And there's a program that's just started at Florida Atlantic University here in Florida that is similar, that is carving out some places for disabled folks. 1 hour, 5, colon.
And then Kirk Adams is running is doing some creative work in that arena. So is John Samuels. And nice. I was talking to somebody last night who was talking about there's a person who wants to start a program to train people to be prompt engineers, you know, to deal with the AI stuff that's out there. I mean, this is the kind of stuff I think we really do need to support in any way we can.
Well, if states are where the action is, we also need to go to our vocational rehabilitation folks. If they're not being as controlled by the feds, we need to try to persuade them to take some directions that begin to be creative and that begin to look ahead. I think that one of the reasons that vocational rehabilitation has not been as successful as it might have been is because they're reactive. They look at the jobs that are there rather than planning for the future.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And I just think, the other thing I would say, Paul, is I was regularly at conventions when you were president. And one of the things I remember a lot of the time is that we would be after the events, we'd be hanging out with a drink in our hands, and we'd be complaining about certain aspects of the Department of Education and how they were screwing things up. And now that we should get those conversations going again and see if there are ways we can improve those things we were complaining about, you know, either through Department of Education or through other means, because, you know, the conservatives these days are sort of
saying what we were, what we've been saying all along in these behind the door sessions. It's sort of fascinating to listen to. So
We have about 1 or 2 minutes to go, Paul. So if there's anything you want to say in conclusion, I know that you are second vice president of the Braille Revival League. What does that do for those who don't know?
Essentially, it's an organization that tries to promote and continue to grow the efficacy of Braille. We think as a mode of communication that's categorically important, and we think that it is slipping in importance over the past 15 or 20 years because of the degree to which people believe that computers and other things can take its place. And
I'm going to make a very powerful statement before we conclude, Paul.
Yes, sir.
Please, let's get rid of UEB.
I don't think that's going to happen.
I know. I know it's
a,
not.
I don't think it's going to happen. Not. And B, I think I could persuade you with relatively little time that it's not a big deal.
It's hard to write in than to read. That's what I'm learning, because I'm learning to write in UEB now, because I have my latest note taker. That's all you can write in. So you have to sort of learn on the fly and how to do it.
What note taker do you have?
The Brilliant.
Yeah, it's not the only way you can write.
Well, you can write computer Braille, but if you want to write Braille to Braille, you have to do the UEB.
No,
I think
you don't.
The optics. Thank you, Trish. The optics of UEB is a little strange, though. You got a whole title in all capital letters, and only the first word is double capped. The rest of it is no caps at all.
It is odd to look at. Thank you guys very much for having me.
Paul, thank you, Paul, for coming on such short notice. We appreciate it.
Yes, we appreciate that, Paul. And keep up with your successes. It's very good to have you with us. Thank you so much. And Trish, thank you, Peter, and everybody else. I'm Bob Branko. Go safe with God's abundant blessings, and you have yourself a great week.